Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we're going to talk about a new science of hope and hopefulness that has the capacity to change the trend of anxiety and depression we are seeing around the globe. And here to talk to us about it is Dr. Dan Tomasulo, author of Learned Hopefulness, The Power of Positivity to Overcome Depression. Dr. Dan has been honored by ShareCare as one of the top 10 online influencers on the issue of depression. He is also the academic director and core faculty member at the Spirituality Mind-Body Institute, Teachers College, Columbia University, and holds a PhD in psychology, MFA in writing, and a master's of applied positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, where he is also an assistant professor to Martin Seligman. Dr. Dan, thank you for coming to the show. And you are having your second appearance today by popular demand.
Oh, Signa, thank you so much for having me back. Just a terrific opportunity here. Just terrific to work with you and spend some time together.
I'm looking forward to it. And I also hear congratulations are due because your book, Learned Hopefulness, was just chosen by Very Well Mind as the best hopeful book on depression for 2022.
Oh, thank you so much for noticing that. It was quite a surprise. The book has been out since, June of 2020. So 2 years later, them acknowledging it in this way really means that it has a message that they're finding, dare I say, hopeful.
Exactly. And I was thinking about something that I learned for you. I know we don't tend to linger on positive thoughts for very long, but I bet some good news like that has a little extra holding power.
It's very true. You know, there's a fine balance between, just kind of absorbing yourself in something just for the sake of the positive element of it and really trying to savor that something good has happened and that you've brought something out into the world that people appreciate. And there's something about being able to acknowledge and savor that lets it linger. And then that fills you up as you're filling other people up. So it does feel good when good things happen.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting when you get some really nice validation. It's still sort of interesting that it doesn't linger quite as long as you'd even expect it to.
No. Bad news always seems to last forever.
Doesn't it?
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's burdensome. But that's why, a lot of the new stuff that I've been doing now has to do with taking either elements from the past and finding ways to savor them, bringing them into the moment, or doing something I call savoring the future, finding future events that you can anticipate, look forward to, and let what's coming fill you up right now.
Dr. Dan, I've heard you say that the tools that psychology has used since its inception have failed to prepare us for the levels of anxiety and depression that we're seeing around the globe that I spoke about in the intro today. Why do you think that is?
I think in the beginning, psychology really followed the medical model. Psychiatrists and then psychologists were really trying to align themselves with a profession that had some status and social standing. And so the medical model was, if you had a disease or a disorder or a difficulty and the physician would take care of that difficulty, make it go away, leave the suffering, then you would be cured. You'd be done. Right. Mm-hmm. But when we start to talk about that in terms of psychology, not being depressed isn't the same as being happy. So when you take away a depression, it tends to be that it only lasts for a short time. 80% of people with depression relapse. And that means that psychology as a science has really failed to keep depression in check and anxiety in check. And so it's really only the last 20 years when we've opened up to studying about positive emotions and how to make that balance happen that we've learned what the other 20% were doing, right? Mm-hmm. What they were doing is finding ways to bring more positivity into their life. And that's what brought a balance and sustainability that you could get out of a depression and stay out.
And I like the metaphor that you use of a seesaw. In that metaphor, the way that I understand it is you have on one side of the seesaw, you have rocks representing negative thoughts.
Yeah.
And on the other side of the seesaw, you have feathers representing positive thoughts. And Dr. Dan, that takes a lot of feathers to balance out the seesaw.
it certainly does. You know, it's funny. I created that analogy to try and help people understand that it's not an even playing field. And the pebbles and feathers metaphor has really stuck with folks. And this idea that can the feathers outweigh the pebbles? Yeah, but you need a lot of them. So it's not about getting one great big feather to balance out all the negativity, some big promotion or relationship or those things are good, but they're not going to make it sustainable. It's this ongoing daily small elements of positivity that's going to fill you up. And in the long run, it's not just a scale that's being tipped with more feathers. It's moving the fulcrum point. Over time, when you can pull that fulcrum point so that the feathers start to take on more value, you do that by having a lot of self-care. Self-care moves that fulcrum point when it's daily, when it's regular, and investing in your character strengths helps to move that fulcrum point as well.
If the feathers represent positivity, can you give some examples of what the feathers would be before I ask my feather questions?
Sure. Well, I always like to start off with gratitude, and rightly or wrongly, when I teach the use of positive interventions, I always start with gratitude because gratitude is always about the past. You don't have gratitude for something that hasn't happened. Mm. You have gratitude for something that's taken place. So it's a really easy place to start with positive emotions. If I ask you to make a list of everything you did yesterday, you could do that. And if I gave you a minute to do that and asked you to do it as quickly as possible, and then I asked you to think about yesterday and highlight the three things that you have gratitude for, the chances are really good, unless you already have a gratitude practice, that the list you made in the beginning of just everything you did yesterday wouldn't include the things you had gratitude for, because we're activating something known as the default network of your brain, which doesn't really hang on to the positive emotions. But when you have a deliberate and intentional review of looking for the good things, of looking for the gratitude, all of a sudden, the things that have happened are there. You've just sort of highlighted them and identified them and brought them forward. So it's that kind of thing I like to start with because it's a low-hanging feather.
The low-hanging feather. Yeah, I like it.
It's there. It's already available. So you can pluck it pretty easily. And then as you get good at it, it changes your default network. It changes the way you think about the past to include more positivity. And as you remember it, as you harvest really that positive emotion, you bring it into the present. And now you get a bigger bang for the buck. So instead of just that event having a beginning, middle, and end, now you've got that event reliving, reactivating the positive biochemistry that came along with that and bringing that into the present. That's a cool thing.
Can you speak a little to the importance of the rocks as well, or why the brain would gravitate more toward the negativity than it would the positivity?
Yeah, we are really, truly wired for worry. You know, if Jack and Sam are outside the cave and Jack says to Sam, I'm going to go inside because I heard some really funky noises. I want to see what they're about. And Sam says, you know, I'm going to wait out here. I don't like those noises. Sam's genes get passed on and not Jack's.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So worrying comes with our DNA, and the negativity bias means that our attention will get hijacked by negative events and negativity, because to worry means to survive. So we might notice that a woman is helping another woman cross the street and think, oh, how kind and how lovely. But if somebody is raising their voice because they just got a parking ticket and they're screaming at the cop and, you know, the voice is escalating and they're flapping their hands, and that's going to hijack our attention because it looks, oh, let's worry about that. And we'll let go of whatever the positivity is. And then as that has continued, we now worry about so many different things that it creates what's called intrusive rumination.
Oh.
We ruminate, and it's intrusive because it feels like we don't have any control over it. And the next thing you know, the pebbles are way outweighing the feathers, and that scale seems to get buried under the rumination, because every time we think about it, it's like throwing another pebble on the scale.
Okay. And, you know, an example that I was thinking about recently is when I have a client come in and maybe their workplace does something called this 360 review, where colleagues will anonymously, you know, give you anonymous feedback about your performance. And what I find so interesting is even if those reviews are 90% positive, but if there's just a little bit of a negative one, it's like, that's the thing. That's the thing that the brain fuses with.
Yeah. Well, I think we get drawn to worrying about things or the negativity because historically the idea is, listen, something's broke. We got to fix it because that'll help us survive. And so sure enough, you can have 99% good reviews, one bad review, and that bad review will create a rumination. It'll start an avalanche, and so the 99 reviews don't match up after a while because rumination continues.
Oh.
Blah, 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 blah. You know, it continues. So the thought becomes just as powerful as the event over time, and so that's why the rumination itself is the culprit. It's not a one-off negative thought that's going to hurt us. It's really the fact that it happens over and over and over and over again. And basically what happens is that activates cortisol and adrenaline. So we have a threat response, right? We're under some kind of threat. And if we feel that, then we're going to get ready. And, you know, everybody knows it, right? It's fight, flight, or flee. So you're either going to attack, run away, or play dead. Not really great choices if you're using that for all the ways to move through life. You're not very creative if those are the only three choices you have about going forward.
It's so interesting. This rumination piece is new to me. This adding that rumination layer is so helpful in understanding it.
I think it's helpful also on the correction side, because deliberate rumination, which is what we're doing when we think about gratitude and when we think about the things that bring us joy and when we think about the things that we feel good about in the future, the anticipatory elements of it. Whenever we're doing deliberate rumination, it means that we're choosing to have thoughts repeat themselves. So when I invite people to think of three good things from the past, I'll also invite them to savor those things and ruminate on them.
Right.
But it's a deliberate rumination. It's not intrusive. That becomes part of the correction. You know,
okay.
They might not weigh the same as an intrusive negative thought, but if you have enough of them, it'll balance the scale.
I love that deliberate rumination. That's genius. Okay. Mm-hmm. So back to my feathers question, but I thought it would be helpful to do a little reviewing of the rocks. What if an individual's energetic resources are low and they are experiencing a prolonged depression? Do you think somebody who has low energetic resources for those reasons is capable of adding to the feathers pile?
I think for sure that that can happen. But there's a little bit of a trick to it. When your resources are low, again, it's an intrusion, right? It's like, gee, I want to do this, but I can't. So it's like saying, geez, I'd like to drive down the block to go to the park or go someplace, but I don't have enough gas. So it's intrusive when you want to do something other than what you're doing, right? So part of the trick is to allow yourself I'm going to call it a luxury.
Okay.
The luxury of not striving, to not put yourself in a contradictory space. If my energy is low, the first thing I want to do is honor the fact that I have to do something restorative. And if that means taking something off my plate, if that means taking a nap, if that means letting me hold myself, hold my own space, or be with somebody who can hold that space for me, what I'm doing is I'm honoring the fact that the reservoir is depleted. But now it's intentional. I'm saying I'm intentionally not going to try to go and do something when I don't have the ability to do that right now. I'm going to honor the fact that I need to feel replenished. And, you know, maybe it's a sign of maturity or aging or something like that. But I've learned that I do really great work early in the morning, but later in the day, my resources are depleted. And now I've perfected the 22-minute nap.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and what happens is if I stop fighting it, if I recognize, no, listen, I just need to do that. When I come back stronger. So when people feel depleted, the idea is to stop the tug of war inside and honor what you need. Do you need rest? Do you need people to be with? Do you need to nurture yourself? Whatever it is, because the moment you acknowledge, it's as if you're aligning your resources with exactly what's happening. Now you're not in conflict anymore. I need a rest. I'm taking a rest. I'm going to do that for 20 minutes. And on the other side of that, I'm going to be refreshed and ready. And then what happens is you're going with the grain, not against it. It's not saying, I want to do this, but I'm so tired, I can't. Now you're always in struggle. But it's like, I want to do this, but I can't do it now until I build myself up. Just like when you have a cold, you don't push yourself. Or if you had the flu, you would say, let me get some rest. Let me hydrate myself and I'll feel better in a day or two. Honoring that, I think, is really important.
So what if you, as a therapist, witnessing another person's process, you mm-hmm. have done, you know, your best to meet someone where they are and to definitely in a reminded them or given them permission to not pick up tools and skills that they might have, that they don't have the energetic resources to pick up. When might you do a little bit of pulling?
The pulling would be based on their history, not on my sense of what they need. One of the first things I would encourage them to do is have a pause for thought about what are they feeling and where are they feeling it. Is it something that is in their shoulders or their back or where is it in their body? The moment that somebody takes stock in what they're thinking and feeling, it shifts the whole dynamic, because if you're having an intrusive ruminating thought and it's dragging you down and it's pulling your energy down with it, then the moment you can step back from it and ask yourself the question, what's happening? And what am I feeling? And where is it in my body that I'm feeling it? Just that shift in your thinking allows you to truncate the depression. It allows you to not ruminate. The intrusive rumination stops when you ask that question. So the first thing to do is to give yourself a chance to step back from it, because the pause is emotional regulation. The pause stops the negativity. So it might not be positive and it might not be an upward spiral, but what it does do is it stops you from going down the rabbit hole of depression and letting your energy be depleted. It's putting a stop to it. So if you think of that as emotional regulation, it becomes a way that you can think about choice. If this is what I'm feeling and where I'm feeling it, what is it that I can do to make change happen? Right. So you stop. You know, it's like stop, drop, and roll, what they taught us in high school. This is kind of like the same thing. You stop, you drop into the emotion, and then you kind of roll with it, meaning that you're not going to strive to do something when the truth of the matter is you don't have enough energy to do it. You accept that this is where you are right now.
I see. And so that is a preliminary piece that needs to happen before going into the hope piece.
I believe very strongly in that, because it's a conscious, deliberate effort at making a change. So even though it looks like nothing, the truth of the matter is you're stopping the rumination, the intrusive rumination. You're taking stock on the implications of the depression. What are my thoughts and feelings in my mind and in my body? And in taking stock, you stop the struggle. You stop depleting resources. And that alone gives some emotional regulation.
Okay. And then in that way, it's more self-directed. So if you would like to add a practice of adding feathers to their toolbox, for example, like doing gratitude, it would be better to wait until they're ready to take the next step to do something like gratitude.
Yeah, you know, that's a great way to put it. The way that I think about that is that always I want to put somebody in contradiction or conflict with themselves, because that's how everything emerges, right? It's not when they're in conflict with me or family members or anybody else. It's when they come into contradiction with themselves, and they'll say, I don't have energy for anything. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. And they can come up with a litany of things that they don't have energy for. I can ask an obverse question. I can say, I can really hear you. And I'm wondering, in the last 3 days, was there anything that you did that brought you even a moment of joy? And typically what you get is somebody saying, no, that wasn't. Oh, you know, I did play with my nephews for about 10 minutes the other night, and that was kind of fun. Oh, really? Well, so it isn't 24/7, 365 that something did happen.
I see.
Right?
I see. That's called
a positive deviant. It means that it might be small, it might be deviant from the rest of their experience, but if you can help somebody locate even a moment that is a differential from their normal emotional space, my goodness, they go, oh yeah, you know, actually that was fun. I really enjoyed that. And actually I kind of look forward to when they come home from school. I spend a few minutes with them and it kind of does fill me up. And so now they are challenged by, oh, I guess I'm not 24/7, 365. Depleted, there are these one or two things. And say, well, that's great. You know, what do you think brought that on? I don't know. I'm in a playful attitude. You get them to think about their own contradictions, and that's where the energy grows.
Okay. Oh, I like that, where the energy grows. That's a nice phrase. And I love hearing you talk about it, because it sounds like it also helps them shine a light on a past experience that was somewhat rewarding or a pleasant activity, and you're kind of giving a little more attention to it than the mind might otherwise.
You're so right. You're so right. And you use the right, the way I think about it anyway, shining the light on it. One of the things when I was writing, doing the research for Learned Hopefulness, one of the things that really stunned me was that they found that the number one predictor for therapy outcomes was the hope the therapist had for their client, right? Not the therapist's hope for their own recovery or improvement, but the therapist's hope for the client. So when the client thought about, you know, they have hope, they think it's, that didn't matter anywhere near as much as the therapist's hope, which really alerted me to the fact that for therapists, you have to be looking for the things in the people that you're working with that really do shine that light on the positive aspect, because you having hope for their recovery, you having hope for their transformation or change is the agent of change in the therapy process.
But how are you defining hope?
It's the belief that you would have control in the future. So there's a few things about that that definition that are important. It's not that you know you have control or that you do have control. It's the belief you have control of some aspect of your future, right? And if you keep it that simple, you want to keep finding ways to facilitate that belief. And you know, a lot of times people are like, well, that's a soft science. That's a bit, well, no. If you think about the multi-billion-dollar drug industry, the entire industry is based on its capacity to beat the placebo effect. Right. Wow. And the placebo effect is the belief that something will or will not have an effect. Right. So it's your belief that something will have an effect in the future. So it's really powerful. It's been around for a long time. And when we distill it into this idea that if you believe you have control over something, well, then that is the definition of hope. And hope, by the way, is different than optimism. Optimism is a more generic sense. I think something good is going to happen is different than I can make something good happen. First one's optimism. The second one is hope.
Another definition that you've brought forward of hope is the only emotion that has both negativity and positivity.
Yeah. Of all the positive emotions, of all the character strengths, hope's the only one that requires negativity or uncertainty to be activated. So, you know, if you look at something like joy, right? Joy doesn't need something negative in order to be fulfilling, right? But if you look at hope, you need to have something negative or uncertain for it to be activated. Otherwise, there'd be no need for hope.
Right. And I was thinking about this too. Let's say that, for example, I was in a sustained pure state of joy. I do not have hope. Is it fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You wouldn't need it.
I wouldn't need it.
And so, you know, the thing that's always captured my attention about hope is that it's a transformative experience, right? That when people have hope, they start to generate this sense of an energetic sense that there's something I can do to make the future better. And what's also fascinating about hope is that it's bidirectional. If I have a goal and the goal is short term, in the next 15 minutes, I'm going to respond to these three emails. And this is called a micro goal, and it's something known as time boxing, where I'm taking a very tight time period and I'm setting very short goals. Well, what happens is if during that 15 minutes, I set those goals, I have the time box, in 15 minutes, they get done. The accomplishment that comes from that, that positivity that comes from that, comes right back into the system and fills me up, because it means, oh, I got it right. I did have control over these three emails in that amount of time. So what happens is that fills me up and I say, all right, you know what? I am going to clear my desk in the next 20 minutes. I'm going to clean this up. And so what happens is the micro goals and time boxing become a way to set a very tight time frame with very small goals that let you feel accomplished. And once that happens, that fills you up to make you want to do more.
Okay. So Dr. Dan, I've also seen a little bit of your writing around high hope individuals. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between someone who is high hope versus low hope?
Yeah, wow, what a great question. You know, the idea too is that when people are hopeful, and they're hopeful on a regular basis. A beautiful study out of Harvard a couple of years ago where they took a look at people who had what could only be called high hope, because they believed that they could control some aspect of their future. Well, you would not believe it. It is like an amazing element. Every feature of their life, from their relationships to their physical well-being, to all forms of mortality, through everything, it's like they have really much, much better lives because of this high hope. So it's not just about, you know, feeling good in the moment or having this sense of, I have hope for this or hope for the future. It's this idea that you have a disposition, a temperament, an attitude that allows you to challenge your perceptions regularly so that you're not being slammed with negativity all the time. We find that people with low hope, as an example, are chronically interpreting things as bad. And what we've learned over and over again in positive psychology is that the interpretation itself becomes the problem. So, you know, high hope people are systematically interpreting what's happening to them with a sense of possibility and a sense of challenge. So when a difficulty comes to them, that difficulty is something they move toward the conflict. They don't avoid it. They don't move away from it. They move toward it. And when they move toward it, they start to think about ways in which they can get some control over it. And this is something that continues to happen over and over and over again with each feature in their life, so that hurdles are seen as challenges, not as only setbacks. And so cultivating that attitude becomes a really powerful and important way for people with high hope to move toward a situation, see it for the opportunities that it may present, rather than low hope people who kind of see things as fixed and set and not really something that they can change very easily. So that's the basis of it. There are actually seven thinking habits of high hope people. And what you want to do is learn how to cultivate those habits. You know, if you think of these seven thinking habits, you know, the people with high hope are constantly looking for possibilities. They're constantly noticing the good, acknowledging that. They're cultivating positivity. They're using their strengths. They're adjusting their goals, using the micro goals and recalibrating all the time. If a goal they set didn't work out, instead of seeing it as a swing and a miss, they recalibrate the goals so it makes it a little more attainable. They engage with purpose. They cherish other people. So when you start to see this this hopeful mindset or this hopeful attitude that they have, you realize that the other side of this is that people with low hope aren't doing that. They're not challenging their thinking. They're seeing things fixed, they're ruminating on the negative, they're focusing on weaknesses. I mean, it's the opposite in each thing. So these thinking habits are really just that. They're habits. They're not God-given. They're not genetic. These are things that we can cultivate. That's what makes this so exciting. It's like we've learned from the high hope people that there are teachable features of hope that we can learn and apply. That to me is exciting.
Well, and then you just answered my question about, you know, can a low hope individual learn to be high hope? And so the answer is yes, because you can learn to cultivate these habits.
Yeah. What I encourage people to do, you know, if they're thinking about, you know, learned hopefulness and trying to improve themselves, is not to try to fix everything all at once. You know, like, as an example, Very, very simple intervention that I would encourage people to use is whenever something strikes you and it feels like, oh, this is, there's no other way to deal with this. You know, this is set, this is fixed, it's bad, it's whatever, is to use a simple declarative sentence when you're having that intrusive ruminating thought. And that sentence is, there's another way to look at this. Mm. Now, it's not a question. You're not asking yourself, is there another way? Because the negative mindset will say, no, there's not. But the declarative sentence, there's another way to look at this, opens the door to possibility. It doesn't tell you what that other way is.
Oh, but I like it.
It's simple, and it loosens the soil of our awareness so that, you know, we're not just stuck in this packed place. There's another way to look at this. And then follow it up when you're ready with a question. What is it I can do to make change happen? Those are like the 1-2 punches
okay.
for loosening things up, you know, because it's like there's another way to look at this. And what can I do to make change happen? Because it takes your mind from that downward spiral, that centripetal force that pulls us down, and it gives us a pause for thought, which is, you know, it's like taking a stick and putting it in the spokes of the wheel for a moment. It's like, wait a minute, let's not just go down this negative road. There's another way to look at this, and what is it I can do to make things happen, or like the 1-2 punch.
Okay, so Dr. Dan, what you've given us a lot of great ideas. But what is one thing that you could suggest to add a little bit of hope in our lives?
I'm actually going to double it up. I'm going to give you a two for one tip.
Okay.
Because the gratitude review is arguably, but likely, the most powerful, easiest way to start training your mind to look for the good, right? And so in the morning, when you wake up, think of 3 things that have happened in the last 24 hours that you have gratitude for. And the more unique they are, the better. So you might say, well, I'm glad yesterday was a nice day. I have gratitude for that. That would be okay. But if yesterday was a nice day and you decided to take a walk and you met a friend that you hadn't seen in 6 months, and that is what you had gratitude for, that would be even better because it's more specific. So you try to...
going into the why?
The specifics. A nice day is good, but if that nice day let you take a walk and you met a friend you hadn't seen, the specifics of it, the thing that made yesterday very unique. So yes, I might have appreciation for the weather, but if I had an appreciation for the fact that it allowed me to take a bike ride that I really enjoyed, that would be even more specific.
Okay.
So a gratitude review of the last 24 hours is, I think, an easy and essential way to start cultivating an awareness of all the good things that are around us. And then the second thing is to look for opportunities to be kind or acknowledge kindness in others.
Hmm.
Because the first one, the gratitude review, takes a there and then a historic approach. Something's already happened, so you're harvesting that positivity. But the kindness brings you into the present moment, and looking for ways to be kind changes your perception of the world. Instead of getting to your next meeting or getting to you think, I hope an opportunity emerges here that allows me to be kind. I'm laughing because there's a technique where you pick one day a week and you do 5 acts of kindness. And my day is Thursday. That doesn't mean if you drop your book on Wednesday, I say, gee, too bad it's not Thursday. I can't help you out. But there was a woman who dropped the package. She was walking toward me and she dropped a small package, but she dropped it on the ground. And I was walking towards her and I couldn't wait to, you know, jump on that thing and help her. And there was somebody right next to her who picked it up. And for a moment, I was like, darn.
Dr. Dan, did you take that person out? I mean, that person really robbed you of an opportunity to be kind.
I could have had that kindness on my list, you know. But it was very funny.
That's a good one.
It's like competitive kindness.
Competitive kindness. And, you know, I love it. Competitive kindness. I think we're on to something here. And by we, I mean you. And it's so interesting. I never have thought of kindness as something that brings you into the present moment.
Yeah, kindness is one of the very few emotions that has this powerful effect called elevation. It's a ripple effect, so that if I do something kind for somebody, I feel good, they feel good. But the real kicker is that anybody witnessing that will feel just about the same thing when they measure that sort of thing. So, you know, it's a real ripple effect. And a few times I've actually written a little bit about it. It's called Not So Random Acts of Kindness. When I see people do kind things, I have found ways to just let them know that it was noticed. Mm. And what's amazing to me is that time and time again, people like acknowledge that it's been acknowledged, but you really see that it just folds into, you know, the phrase that comes to mind is people say, listen, it's what I could do. You know, I'm just glad I could help. And they roll right through it, you know. So I like that, too, that it's not, we don't have to throw a parade or a right. party for it. But acknowledging it feels good, and letting people know that their kindness has been witnessed, I think, has a ripple effect as well.
Now I'm excited to just go outside of the studio and be kind, and I really hope someone doesn't try to get in my way, Dr. Dan. I'm going to take them down, anybody who tries to get in my way.
What did you do? Try to be kind to me?
I was just trying to be kind.
None of that.
So, Dr. Dan, is there anything that you're creating right now that you're particularly excited about?
I have a 3-book series that I'm in the middle of, and it's called The Positivity Effect. And with this, I've reviewed the material on cognitive behavioral therapy. Because it is indeed the best psychology has to offer in terms of helping people change, and it's not good enough. And when you look at the research, what you find out is that in CBT studies, they get really good treatment effects and really miserable relapse effects. So it means that the treatment works, but it doesn't last. Mm. And then when you start to see now what does last, it's when you add positive emotions, the activation of positivity, to what we have with CBT. So it's really not usurping or trying to undermine the research that's been done, because it's been magnificent. And now there's this new way of understanding what's going to tip the scale in terms of relapse prevention, in terms of a genuine healing or correction. It's going to be teaching people how to not just get out of a bad place, but stay out toward more positive emotion. And so that was really fun to write, and lots of cool research that I had to come across and be aware of as I put it together.
Well, I want to thank you for the work you do helping individuals find hope, even in their darkest times. And I was thinking about your work, and I really appreciate how accessible you make this information, and it's like you make it accessible through the storytelling that you do, while at the same time it's grounded in science. I feel like the stories make it easier to remember.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that, because, my original hope was to be a writer, a storyteller. And when I went to college, I did really well in psychology. It was like, you know, the rest of the stuff, maybe not so well, but the psychology, I seem to understand that. And then I couldn't really see myself in as a writer without some training. So I used the psychology as a way to train myself. But then, you know, for the PhD, the academic writing just about ruined my brain. And it wasn't until afterwards, and I went back for an MFA, that it was like, oh, wait a minute. It's really blending storytelling with positive psychology, where there's some genuine value. There's something there,
right?
Because people need to relate. It's one thing to say do 5 acts of kindness, but if you tell a story about it,
right,
people like they remember the story, they remember the information, and it seems to be a very organic and natural way to bring this material alive.
Thank you for coming today, Dr. Dan.
My pleasure, Sigmund.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. See you next month.